good evening, everyone. Just making sure this one's on. Thank you so much for being here. I really want to welcome everybody and welcome our senior Lowy fellow, Richard McGregor, for coming here tonight at the Lowy Institute event series at the NGV. My name is Lydia Khalil. I'm also a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight. And we're really pleased to welcome Richard here, like I said, and we're launching his new Lowy Institute paper published by Penguin Random House here in Australia called Xi Jinping, The Backlash. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to read it yet, tonight will be a great introduction into the topic that Richard covers in the book, and I really encourage you to get your hands on a copy. It's a very pithy read, very astute reading of the state of affairs in China today. And it's a great description, I think, of the growing concerted international push against an increasingly assertive Xi Jinping and the country that he leads. So,
also on sale outside.
That's right. Yeah. Can't forget to say that. But in that book, in Xi Jinping, The Backlash, Richard describes an ascendant and an assertive China led by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who, as Richard has written in his book, just to give you a little taste, has transformed China at home and abroad with a speed and assertiveness that few foresaw when he came to power in 2012. And in this book, he outlines both Xi's rise and how he's being met with an increased resistance, not only internationally but abroad, by this emerging coalition of nations who are now determined to resist China's geopolitical and tech expansion. Now, this is what we're going to get into tonight. I'd like to introduce Richard to you. He doesn't really need much by way of introduction. His reputation precedes him. He's been a senior journalist and leading expert on China, China's political system and Asian geopolitics for some time now. He was the Financial Times bureau chief in Beijing and Shanghai between 2000 and 2009. He headed the Washington office for 4 years in 2011, and prior to joining the FT, he was working for The Australian. He is an award-winning author of The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers, and Asia's Reckoning, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century. And now we're very lucky to have him as a senior fellow with us at the Lowy Institute. So welcome to Melbourne, Richard, and thank you again for coming. So we have a good crowd tonight. I'm sure the audience has a lot of questions, and I want to leave ample time for that, but I'm the moderator, so I get prerogative to ask the first few. And I want to start off by a question that gets to the main thesis of your book, which is that President Xi Jinping is an assertive leader, and China under him is finally facing a concerted and coordinated backlash, both domestically and internationally. And I guess my question goes to, well, why now? It's not like it was any surprise to anybody that China has been sometimes a bad actor in the international economy and in the international scene. We know that China's not a democracy. It's been run under a strict one-party rule for some time now. So all of the objectionable behavior that China has displayed is not new to us. So why are we facing this backlash now?
Thanks, Lydia, and thanks, everybody, for coming here. I mean, I should say, first of all, that I'm not saying in my book that Xi Jinping is in trouble, that he's about to lose his job or anything like that. What I've tried to describe in different ways is the his critics and his opponents at home, and as you say, the coordinated or increasingly coordinated opposition abroad. You say concerted and coordinated. I think that's true. It's concerted at home within sections of the elite in particular, and increasingly coordinated abroad. It's definitely not coordinated at home because that would be dangerous to do that. So just to sort of summarise it, if you like, I think it's pretty obvious overseas. There's not agreement on how to handle China, to push back against China, but there's more conversations, particularly amongst democracies, than there ever has been. I moved back to Australia last year, and I often think in Australia we tend to think that, oh gosh, it's just about us and China, but it's happening everywhere in the world. Maybe we led with our chin a couple of years ago or whatever. But if you look in Canada, you look in Singapore, which has been through the tumble dryer with China a few times in recent years, you look at Germany and France, which have changed the EU policy on China, you look at Japan, which obviously has particular historical dimension into its problems with China, South Korea, a few years ago, subject to big sanctions from China, and of course, most importantly of all, is the US, which is trying in a very haphazard and I would say ham-fisted way, trying to round up countries. So that's abroad. At home, if I can summarize it like this, you know, I think I've tried to divide it up, and this is rather crude and simplistic. He has, Xi Jinping has what you might call good enemies and bad enemies. Mm-hmm. The bad enemies, the anti-corruption campaign, and we might come back to this, mm-hmm. has destroyed vast numbers of rich, powerful, privileged people, and along with it, their families. And that's the sort of impact on a political system in any country that just doesn't disappear. So there's many people in China who were once very powerful and would love to see Xi Jinping fall flat on his face. The good enemies, if you like, which we might describe as the technocratic elite, the people, the scholars and the like, who I think have been broadly supportive of what you might call in China's, you know, sort of incremental institutionalization of various mores, gradual legal reform, etc., etc. They dislike Xi Jinping intensely for his the way he's wound back human rights issues, legal reform in particular. Mm-hmm. Above all, symbolically by appointing himself president in perpetuity, and we can talk about that later. But I think they think he's taken China backwards. Mm. And I think as many of those people would also think that he's mishandled relations with the US, only, if you like, by showing China's hand too early and bringing on a conflict which might have been inevitable, but he certainly brought it on by the way he's behaved. So that's what I try and look at in different ways. And also overriding that, finally, is the Communist Party itself, which more than any other leader for decades, he's put at the centre of politics and policy making.
So that brings me to the next question really nicely. When I was reading how you were describing how he brought the Chinese Communist Party to the centre of China, I was in a way really surprised to read that because, you know, I'm a casual observer of China, by no means an expert, but the message out there, you know, whether it's through the media or by China's reputation, is that the country and the party or the government and the party are one. And in your book, you say, well, that's even more so the case with under President Xi Jinping. I had already thought that to be the case. So can you talk about the difference in what he's done in bringing the party more centrally to the fore?
You know, I think, you know, in broadly speaking, you know, the party and the government are separate. Obviously, they overlap because there's, you know, everybody high up in the government, except with one or two exceptions, are party members and party officials. Broadly speaking, you know, the party sets policy direction. The government is the executive function. And I think that's been totally blurred under Xi Jinping. It's been blurred in you know, philosophically. Xi Jinping's chief lieutenant said, forget about this distinction between the party and the government. It doesn't matter anymore. This was a distinction, by the way, that was sort of emphasized by Deng Xiaoping in an attempt to, you know, professionalize the government and sort of take politics out of it to an extent. Under Xi Jinping, they've been quite explicit and said that's gone. And you actually look at some former executive functions. If you look at the Religious Bureau, if you look at how they handle film and television, media, all sorts of things which used to be actually in government have been taken out and put directly under party departments and the like. So they've gone out of their way to emphasise the centrality of the party. And I think if you do that, you are emphasising the centrality of politics, if you like, over pragmatism or pragmatic policy making.
That makes sense. So I wanted to also ask you about this anti-corruption push that you referred to earlier. You said when he came to power, he kind of hit the panic button and went running full steam ahead on this huge anti-corruption push in China, which had all sorts of different fallout. I was wondering if you could talk about what it looked like and whether the anti-corruption push was, I guess for lack of a better word, genuine, meaning did he really want to use this as a way to better China, root out corruption, or was it more of a power consolidation move that we've seen other authoritarian leaders do in the past?
You know, there's no doubt there's an element of power consolidation to it, because there have been people who might have been rivals and could have been potentially appointed as successors who've been pushed aside. But I think it's far too big to talk about it as simply a power struggle, as some people do. I do say at the, you know, it's quite amazing when you look at when Xi Jinping came to power, he did back one thing after another with absolute alacrity, push the panic button, as it were. Now, why did he do that? Without getting too much into the weeds, he was appointed as the leader in waiting in 2007. And if you go back to 2007, nobody said at the time that we had this sort of hard-ass new leader coming in who was going to shake everything up. He was a compromise candidate at the time. So what happened between 2007 and 2012? I'd say a couple of things happened. First, we had the Bolshe Lai scandal and the scandal of another senior Politburo member who, if you believe the official Chinese press, were attempting a kind of soft coup against Xi Jinping. I think that's one reason why when he got into power, he swept everybody aside, because he thought people were working against him in a way which hasn't happened in Chinese politics for some time. And I think secondly, all the sorts of pillars of party power in the military. Remember, about 100 generals have been charged with anti-corruption. You know, one of the most senior generals, I think he died in hospital while he was under investigation. Another one hung himself. So if you look at the military, the state enterprises, particularly in the energy sector, or as they call it in China, the petroleum gang, it's quite a good phrase. They, military, state enterprises, propaganda, all ridden with corruption. In other words, all the sorts of pillars of party power threatened to crumble. And I think that's another explanation for why he's she, if you like. Why has he behaved in the way that he's behaved? Because if he believes in anything, it's in the absolute centrality of party power. Only the party has the right to run China. Only the party can run China. And I think if you think of it like that, you start to get a better explanation for his actions.
Right. And you talked, too, about how he looked to the Soviet Union and how he was horrified by what happened there. You know, we hear about how Putin took the decline or the collapse, really, of the Soviet Union as a driving force in his governance. But it seems like President Xi also did as well, and about the... And that kind of reinforced his belief in the centrality of the party.
Yeah, so in the 1990s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, I think we had one of the things the Chinese did at that time, or at the top of the party, everybody had to study the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there was a vast literature produced on it at that time. So we fast forward to about 2012, 2013, 14. In the intervening time, the Chinese economy had grown by about 34 times. It wasn't, you know, a sclerotic mess like the Soviet Union was, but they went through the same process. He ordered people to go through the same process to study the collapse of the Soviet Union, to study what happened to the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, to study why it became weak, so weak that it collapsed quickly. And part of that is ideological. To give, you know, not only does Xi Jinping revere all Chinese leaders of the Communist Party, you know, he doesn't trash anybody. He also talks about the importance of Lenin and Stalin. In other words, you know, he's not one to go for the Khrushchev speech and the like and trash past Soviet leaders. You know, because after all, the Chinese system is designed along the lines of Lenin. You know, in fact, the I remember when I first went to China in the 1980s, and I think in October, around National Day, in the middle of Tiananmen Square, they eventually took this down. They would have big pictures of Lenin, Stalin, Marx, and Engels. The joke at the time was that these pictures, the four pictures together, was the history of shaving. it was a reminder to me that, you know, that the ideology which we think has disappeared sort of, is sort of still deeply embedded in the core of the system.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting. So this system that China is trying to sustain, you say if China does manage to sustain it, it will rebuff the idea that only free markets are the path to prosperity. And then if they are able to sustain it, that will really mark a new era in the globe. Can you explain a bit more by what you mean about that? And secondly, what do you think China's prospects are in its ability to sustain it?
You know, if we put this in the context, for example, of US-China, which is the big, you know, the contest of the century, if you like, you know, that's trade. It's over trade. It's over economics. It's over regional power, broader geopolitical power. It's over technology, which is why we hear people talk about the digital Cold War and the like. But it's also about ideology. It's about competing systems. You know, can China export its system? As it is in China now, I think no. Because if you think about, you know, think about another country, Kazakhstan, Angola, both countries where China is very active in, you know, could you have sort of a similar Communist Party departments in those countries? Could they work like China? No. They haven't got the sort of deep bureaucratic roots and the like. But what China can do, and it is increasingly openly talked about, is to sort of export the mechanisms or the capillaries of an authoritarian system, the surveillance system, the credibility of an efficient authoritarian regimes, particularly which in China has delivered results, maybe not elsewhere. And I think all of that in some way plays back into protecting the system at home. You make it stronger abroad, you make it stronger at home, and you make it a better and stronger contrast against democracy. And of course, the symbol of democracy is the United States. You know, in the Communist Party's propaganda department has always had one of its core tenets, which is trashing America and trashing democracy. Now, America may be doing a pretty good job itself these days of doing that. But nonetheless, I think that's a big part of the contest we're seeing. It's about much more than trade and technology. I think it's systemic as well.
Mm. But I do want to ask you, though, about trade and with the U.S., this trade war that's brewing. I think it was last week, a few days ago, Trump fired off this tweet announcing that the U.S. would impose an additional 10% tariff on an additional $300 billion worth of goods from China. And that seems to be a pretty significant escalation in this. But and you know, you talk in your book about how Americans have kind of come to a consensus that is generally hawkish toward China now. But at the same time, in your book, you write that America's trade policy or policy with China is largely incoherent. Why is that? What's going on with the U.S. and China?
Well, I mean, there's incoherence at the top with Trump, but let me come back to that. But there's also another level of incoherence is on the one hand, we've got what we call decoupling, the buzzword, in other words, the U.S., and for not entirely bad reasons, trying to separate its economy from China's economy. In other words, to get certain technologies, manufacturing capabilities, skills out of China on national security grounds, so they're not dependent on China in any of those areas. So on the one hand, we've got decoupling. On the other hand, you've got American demands for greater access to the Chinese market. So greater enmeshment and greater decoupling. And I think you see that in the two different arms of the US administration, the likes of Peter Navarro, the Uber hawk, who wants decoupling. Trump, I think, in some respects, emotionally, is in that camp, you know, bring it all home. And you've got people in Treasury and maybe in USTR, the US Trade Representative's Office, with a different view. So it's incoherent in that respect. Mm. But yeah, Trump tweets, though, I think China, to give Trump credit, he really destabilized the Chinese initially because they thought initially they'd sort of bought him off like people do by flattering him, giving him a tour of the Forbidden City. Mm-hmm. He said he'd been treated better than any US president ever in history, blah, blah, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, Trump then started sort of firing shots at them, threatened them with tariffs, followed through with tariffs. I think they had no idea how to respond to Trump. They had no idea what he'd do next, of course, which is the value of it. But I think a year or two on, that the Trumpian approach is now wearing thin. The Chinese no longer respond to Trump's tweets. They're basically refusing to negotiate unless they get their bottom line is met. That explains the kind of slow or stately pace of negotiations at the moment, because the Chinese are saying, well, we're not going to give you this, we're not going to give you that. And so what does Trump do? He has to keep upping the ante. That's what he does. That's why we got the latest round of tariff negotiations. And I think the Chinese have concluded, perhaps correctly, that no matter what they give Trump, you know, he'll be back 2 weeks later for more. I mean, I think if you look at Trump, I mean, I lived in the States most recently before I moved back to Sydney, but, you know, Trump at home has immigration, symbolized by the war between the US and Mexico. So he, whatever happens, he has to keep throwing that out there. And I think overseas, he has China. So no matter what deal he does, he still wants an excuse to run on this issue. So, and I think the Chinese realize that, and they realize it's pointless looking for a grand bargain because one is simply not available.
So do you think that that is a sign that China believes that a Cold War-style confrontation is inevitable? Or is this just, you know, them being tired of Trump?
I think it's more the former, actually, because as you say, there's a degree of bipartisanship in a tougher line with China in Washington. You know, previously, before sort of Trump took over the Republican Party and put them all in his thrall and scared them all into agreeing with him. you know, the Republicans were the free traders. The Democrats, like Chuck Schumer, who's the minority leader in the Senate, he's the protectionist or more protectionist. That's all changed now. And so if you look at US politics now, in the Senate, you have Mark Warner from Virginia, Marco Rubio from Florida, Democrat and Republican, really working on the same page in trying to think of measures against China. So I think whatever happens in the US election next year, it's very difficult to see any candidate, particularly in the swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and the like, which Trump won last time, you know, running on a platform which says, let's rejoin the TPP and sit down at the table and talk sensibly to China, because it's hard to see that there are any votes in it.
Right. Well, I did promise to leave time for audience question, but I want to just finish off my questions to you to ask you about Australia. You don't seem to have a lot of confidence in Australia's ability to effectively straddle its alliance relationship with the US and then its other relationship with China. You say that China's been very good at playing in that space of war and peace, but you're not so confident in Australia's ability. How come?
Well, I don't know whether I'd say I'm not confident, but it's just incredibly difficult. And I think once we accept that, then maybe we'll be better about it. You know, somebody I think put it the other day quite well, you know, Australia's strategic holiday is over. And maybe that's been the case for some time, but it's just much more obvious now. And, you know, so you get somebody like Mike Pompeo, for example, the US Secretary of State, giving a press conference in Sydney yesterday and sort of leaving hanging there that the US might ask Australia to put missiles in Darwin or something like that. And I think the government was, you know, quite right to sort of get on the radio this morning and say, nobody's asked us to do that and we're not thinking about it because it's quite a big deal. But I think that, you know, I mean, we're not used to, I don't think we've got the statecraft, the sort of diplomatic DNA, the practice to deal with what faces us in coming years. You know, the positive side of that is that few countries do, and we're all grappling with the same problem. You know, I think Australia kind of lives in fear of some form of economic coercion from China. And in that respect, I mean, I think, and we could go into detail on that, I think it's less likely than it looks, but the truth is we think we've taken a lot of tough decisions like Huawei and the Foreign Agents Registration Act, you know, on Chinese influence or interference operations. You know, we think we've taken a lot of tough decisions, but the truth is we have not really been tested yet. And if there were to be some form of economic coercion, or if China did single us out in a particular way, if we had the sort of problem that Canada has, which was just unlucky, you know, having this Huawei executive going through Canada on her way to Vancouver and got caught up in the US extradition case, that could have been us as well. So I just think we need to steel ourselves and get ready for what could be a lot of all manner of difficult situations. And then that, of course, doesn't even contemplate some military conflict. Now, I don't think that's on the horizon. I don't think China's about to invade Taiwan or anything like that. But there's multiple ways in which that could occur. Accidents at sea, accidents on the high seas in the South China Sea, something between Japan and China, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to, at some stage, have to grow up very quickly when all that does come to pass.
So some challenges ahead for Australia, and your book offers a very good kind of a strategic analysis of what's going on to help us. So as promised, I want to open it up to the audience for questions. We have two microphones roving around, so just throw your hand up. I might take maybe three questions at a time and then have Richard answer as he would.
Thank you. Joe Foley is my name. I just wanted to ask about what China means, or Xi Jinping means, by corruption. Is it fiddling in the expenses, claiming for an overnight stay in thing, or booking a helicopter, or giving yourself the royalties to a coal mine, or, you know, is it controlling the drugs trade, or what is corruption in China?
Thank you. My name is Casey. There have been suggestions that China's model is one more of a civilizational state rather than, you know, nation state. I'm just wondering if Mr. McGregor, might comment on any suggestions that I'm not looking at any sort of a binary kind of a comparison, but if you have any comments on the prospects of, you know, instead of looking at the development of China's model in terms of an end of history kind of a view, rather than the prospects of, you know, a developing global model of order. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McGregor, before you were returned, I think Australia committed the first sin in this area, if you want to call it sin, by the sale of the port of Darwin to Beijing interests. Since then, we've had the knockback of Huawei, Parliament's refusing the extradition treaty, something that I think has received too little attention, especially given what's happened in Hong Kong. The Four Corners program on Beijing's influence in Australia. I'm surprised, and I wonder if you are, that there has been the backlash to the extent there has been, given the fact there has been so much effort by China to influence political parties, the media, business. Are you surprised at the extent of the backlash to the extent it's been? And
are you saying it should have been bigger?
I'm surprised that it's even the size that it was,
right,
given the fact of what China's been up to here in Australia for a long period of time. But my real point is, even this backlash and even more, so what? Aren't we just, to quote Chairman Mao, just a paper tiger as far as this backlash is concerned? How is it really affecting China's strategic moves in this region? It doesn't invalidate their control of the South China Sea, where 60% of Australia's maritime trade transits.
So three really good questions.
Corruption is many things. The corruption is what you might in China is also what it is here. Maybe not riding on the helicopter, but taking money, getting the proceeds of the coal mine put into your personal account, you know, bribery, fraud, all that sort of thing. But it's more than that in the Communist Party, because you remember it's, you know, the party has its own internal system for combating corruption. So when you look at the charges against people or what they go down for, it's more than just fraud and bribery or the accumulation of illicit wealth. It's often sort of licentious behaviour, having a mistress, having multiple mistresses, because corruption is also going against the party's rules. And the party's rules, in theory, hold your personal behaviour to a higher level than the average person. So it encompasses both, you know, fraudulent, ordinarily corrupt behaviour and personal misbehaviour, if that explains it. On the civilizational state stuff, you know, I know a lot of people put this around. The Australian scholar Ross Terrell used to write about it years ago. I think Martin Jakes wrote about it in his How China Will Rule the World book. I never managed to get through that. And I've never really, to be quite honest, I'll admit this, I've never really understood what it meant. And in China's case, I mean, I appreciate your saying sort of binary thing, but China, you know, obviously has, you know, it talks about itself and Chinese all around the world in a civilizational sense. But it strikes me, you know, is it much more of Westphalian state? Utter and absolute focus on sovereignty and the like and borders. So I'm not quite sure whether it's a mix of one or the other, but I'm also going to plead a bit of ignorance because I've never really grasped what it meant. So maybe I've got to go back and hit the books. Michael, you know, I think it's, you know, it's amazing being in Australia because it's like nowhere else in the world. I think, you know, China is on the front page every day. And the even last week in the terms of conflicts, you know, we had the Crown Casino stuff. We had our champion swimmers fighting. We had the coal stuff, influence. It's just happening just in just about every arena, actually. So I think it's, and I don't, you know, and if you look at the Lowy poll, then those sort of criticisms of Chinese behaviour have now seeped through to public opinion. So I think it's, you know, backlash might be a hard word, but it's certainly the level of, you know, people say in Australia we should have a more nuanced debate in China, maybe, maybe not. But I think, you know, in some ways we're ahead of what everybody in the world is going to go through and having a big debate. Are we a paper tiger? Well, if we're a paper tiger, China wouldn't be as angry with us as they are, you know, because not only do they think that we have, you know, shouted from the rooftops in Australia about, you know, influence and interference operations, they think we've gone around the world and told everybody else to watch out for it as well. So they think we're a bit of a ringleader. So maybe not so much of a paper tiger. On the South China Sea, one point about that, of course, is that it might be 60% of our trade or whatever. I've went into these figures once, but 90% of Australian trade going through the South China Sea is going to China. So that brings you to the real oddness of the relationship and of our fears in some respects, because are they Chinese going to interdict trade going to China? Probably not. But it does bring us to sort of the weirdness of the situation, because in order to, and other countries are in the same position as us, by the way, Japan and South Korea in particular, in order for Australia to sort of, you know, fund its budget, which in turn to fund its military, to protect itself against China, we need China to succeed because China's kind of paying for it at the end of the day. And so that's either a kind of virtuous or a vicious circle, one or the other or both. So, you know, I don't know when we sort of break out of that.
Zara Kimpton from the Australian Institute of International Affairs. I wonder whether you could comment a bit further about the situation in Hong Kong, both sort of on the short term, but also in the long term, how this is going to affect Xi, whether it be sort of lack of face if it doesn't sort of sort itself out fairly quickly.
Then there was a question in the front, Ambassador.
Thank you, Richard. You mentioned Taiwan and you said you don't think China will invade Taiwan. I think you're probably right. But contacts of mine in Beijing a year or so ago were saying that Xi Jinping really wanted to establish for himself a legacy. He wanted to put himself on a par with Mao Zedong. And that legacy was going to be regaining Taiwan. Now, probably not by invasion, by making himself president for life, potentially. He's given himself time for a different approach, take over Taiwan by slow strangulation. But that's what he wants as his legacy. Got some thoughts on that?
Maybe we'll take one more from this side of the room.
Thank you. Adam from RMIT University. I was just in Beijing just recently, and I was at a couple of dialogues where I was speaking with scholars from various institutions, and one of the things that sort of really came through was that they were very upset that at the lack of political reform there. I just wanted to get, your opinion on what those reforms should be and how might they happen, I guess. It seems like there are a lot of structural inconsistencies between the party at the moment and versus what needs to happen in the economy. And I was just wondering what that means to you. Thanks.
Hong Kong, and Hong Kong relates to Taiwan, obviously, but, you know, it's really amazing what's happening in Hong Kong. I lived there during the handover in 97. I'm not saying that, you know, I sort of drunk the Chinese Kool-Aid on, you know, their view was that, you know, Hong Kong is a commercial city, not a political city. But, you know, it seemed to be a little bit like that. You know, one of the legacies of British colonialism, the Brits never built a democratic system there until about the last 5 or 10 years. And it was only, I think, you know, they started to build up a political culture there. But I never knew what we've seen in Hong Kong today has all been bottled up there. But I suppose particularly amongst young people. But in Hong Kong, we've seen the legal community protesting, the finance community protesting, civil servants, you know, Cathay Pacific pilots and the like, about the last, you know, class of people you'd ever expect to have a political bone in their body. So where does it go? I mean, it's a very difficult situation for China, you know, sending in the troops to Hong Kong. I mean, well, actually, they're in Hong Kong, right downtown, the PLA. But the Chinese have tried to stop the PLA being involved in putting down civil disturbances. They have another arm of the military for that. So I don't know where it goes. It's like a slow-running mess. It's very badly timed for China on another level. I mean, actually, Xi Jinping can do very little, by the way, because he can't stop news of it like you can from China, and he can't intervene in the management of it. And the government of Hong Kong has kind of lost control and the police have lost respect. But it's badly timed in another way because we've got the Taiwan presidential election next January. You know, Hong Kong is a sort of prototype, you know, one country, two systems. It turns out to be a complete disaster. We don't know what's going to happen in the Taiwan election. At the moment, there's two candidates. If more people enter, that might be bad for the current incumbent. But the Hong Kong unrest is helping the current incumbent, Tsai Ing-wen, who's the last person that China wants to win. On to Colin's point about, you know, Xi Jinping's legacy in Taiwan. You know, the Taiwan approach, the Chinese approach to Taiwan right now is full on, you know, what, psych ops, if you like. If you want to look at an interference operation, you know, Taiwan is where it's really happening. You've got various Taiwanese media, which is owned virtually by China, pumping out pro-China messages, attacking the current president. You've got these semi-gangster figures. Some of you who've studied Taiwan will know about the White Wolf, who's running a big agenda there for China inside Taiwan. You know, they're sort of undermining or eating away at the democratic system from within. I'm not sure that will work in Taiwan because it's a kind of, you know, a feisty democratic culture there. And if we get back to, you know, if they keep losing the debate in Taiwan, then we get back to the military option. And maybe China could win a war before the Americans get there. But that, you know, misses the point in some ways because if, you know, when China occupies Taiwan, that's when the trouble begins, not when it finishes, because you simply won't have the population going along with it. So I don't know how they manage and how they manage to win that issue and how they manage to sort of, he manages to win Taiwan as a legacy. I really find that difficult to game out. And on the reform, political reform issue, you know, that Xi Jinping has had a slightly pragmatic streak in him on this issue. If you look at, he's very much emphasised, you know, centrality of the party, talked up the state sector of the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But when the economy started to slow quite rapidly late last year, you know, he seemed to turn around a little bit. You know, one of the biggest areas that people have been able to openly criticise Xi in is on the economy. Economic policy in China is always much more open to free to openly debate in China. So you saw late last year Xi starting to embrace, at least rhetorically, the private sector. You know, the private sector in China, I know private companies, Chinese private companies aren't exactly like private companies elsewhere, but they are entrepreneurial and they're responsible for 70% of output. And so you saw Xi Jinping inviting, private company executives to the Great Hall of the People, et cetera, et cetera, to try and sort of give them his blessing, because I think he'd been persuaded that he needed them. Long-term, and just briefly, the issue of reform, it's one of those terrible words in China, because how they define reform is is different from how we define reform. We think reform means more like us. They think reform means fine-tuning their system. And from their perspective, that they're obviously right. But I think in the longer term, you know, there's a strong school of thought talking about, you know, hybrid private-public sector, making them sort of work together or rescue each other or something like that. So the model in China is still being implemented. It does it conflict with the centralization of the political system? Maybe. You know, let's wait and see.
Well, I think we have time for one more round of questions, if there are any last questions from the audience.
Hi, Richard. My name's Ellen. I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the backlash at home and what that might look like over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, how it might play out and whether...
At home in China.
At home in China, sorry, in the domestic arena, and whether we'll ever get to know anything about it.
My name's Stephen Richard. The issue about surveillance, as a student of history, when you look at the various dynastic changes in China, there are certain similar criteria, and one is that you anger the peasantry, and I'm wondering whether surveillance could be that issue.
Just a final question.
Thank you, Paula Giles. I'm interested in the One Belt, One Road initiatives, and particularly as it's playing out in the South China Sea and the Pacific Islands, and the sort of debt-encouraged strategy that China seems to be using as a form of soft and potentially later hard influence and power.
Well, yes, we don't know much about what happens in China, really. You know, that's one of the, you know, the US, I think, is vastly overreported. One reason why it is because there's so much to report. You know, you can virtually sit at President Trump's desk these days and hear everything that's going on around him. China is vastly underreported, and in some ways that's because we know very little. What's going to happen in 5 or 10 years? I mean, I do stick my neck out a little bit in the book, and if I'm wrong, we can all forget it. I do think the issue of the succession will come back. You know, idea that he's president for life. I really wonder whether he's going to be able to get away with not appointing a successor for too much longer. I guess the crunch time is 2022. And maybe starting in 2021. The next party congress is 2022. Well, by the time we get to 2021, that's when all the, you know, we start, the, you know, the, it's like a political machine, and that's when he's got to start moving people around, making appointments and the like. So I really think the issue of the public debate about the succession will come above ground, and that we'll see if that has any impact how he behaves. One reason I might say, and I should have said this, that I think he did make himself president for life or in perpetuity, however you want to put it, is because he has so many enemies that he did step down, then his family, his cronies, his supporters would be under threat of being locked up themselves. So it's a self-protection mechanism as well. Will we know much about it? I don't know. Surveillance. Yeah, the surveillance thing is very interesting. China has, the bat companies, the Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, which cover the main areas of the internet. They're all private companies. Why are they private companies? Because when the internet came along, there were no legacy state companies for them to shunt aside. China, I think, has done a remarkable job, much better than anybody ever thought, of combining the surveillance capabilities of the internet and big data with the ability to use them to drive the economy and e-commerce. And they've exceeded all manner of expectations there. You don't see the same debate that you see in Western countries about big data and surveillance, but there is a debate in China on privacy, whether that becomes something much, much bigger. I'm not so sure, to be honest. The bat companies are tremendously valuable as a tool of surveillance in this respect, because they give they're like a real-time, privately owned, efficiently run digital intelligence agency. Just the country's awash in real-time data in the way that it never was before. When I first wrote that phrase in the book, I think I said like a sort of real-time, privately run digital Stasi, and then I looked at the word Stasi and I thought, it's a bit harsh, I'll take that out. So that was me, my kowtow. But so I think another reason why, when China is so manifestly successful economically, why are they still on the edge of their seats? And I think the surveillance state has something to do with that, because, the top leaders or state security knew a lot before, but now they really know what's going on in the country comparable to before. And I don't think it necessarily makes them feel more secure, maybe less secure. On the BRI, the BRI is a big topic. I'm, of course, in the state of Victoria tonight, which is a signatory to the BRI, ahead of the rest of Australia in that respect. The BRI, it's become a little bit of a catch-all phrase. The Belt and Road, in theory, was through Eurasia. The belt goes through overland. The road, paradoxically, goes through the Indian Ocean and the like. But now BRI has become a catchphrase for just about, one day it goes through the Antarctic, the next South America, then through New Zealand, not yet through Australia. But you will notice the Australian government has changed its language on the BRI these days. They talk about it in a positive way. So it'll be interesting to see whether there's some follow through in a policy sense. I'll say two things on the debt issue. I don't think there's a purpose to conduct debt trap diplomacy, but they would be happy to take advantage of it on occasion if that happened. The second thing, we hear a lot of criticism of Belt and Road from outside of China. I think what is often missed is the enormous amount of criticism inside China. One from the technocrats again, who think it's a huge waste of money, who think there's reputational damage from the debt trap stuff. And I think it's probably pretty unpopular with the broader population. I think ordinary Chinese like foreign aid as much as ordinary Australians. In other words, not much at all. And when they had the China-Africa summit last year and China had the big picture figure, I think it was $60 billion they were giving to African countries, the Chinese internet came alight with fury about why are we giving this money to African countries when we have so many problems at home. So the BRI has been recalibrated at the big summit this year, and I think it should be more focused and hopefully from the Chinese perspective attract fewer poor headlines.
Well, Richard, this has been so fantastic. We really want to thank you again for coming. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the audience has learned a lot. There's copies of the book available outside for you to take a look at, hopefully purchase, and I want you to join me in thanking Richard for coming here to Melbourne tonight to discuss all of this. Thank you.